Today is Tuesday, October 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, new developments in the case of a missing journalist believed to have been murdered in the Saudi consulate in Turkey.
We're working very close with Saudi Arabia and with Turkey, and they're working together to figure out what happened.
High-level talks between the two Koreas have led to more proposals toward normalizing relations. Claims of voter suppression in some U.S. states as the midterm elections approach weeks from now, and another royal baby on the way.
I think it's kind of a Cinderella story. It's wonderful to see good news.
It's all on today's International Edition. Saudi Arabia is reportedly ready to concede that a missing Saudi writer was killed in its consulate in Istanbul. CNN is among the media outlets reporting that the Saudi government is preparing to say Jamal Khashoggi died during an interrogation and abduction that went wrong. The report, which was attributed to two unnamed sources, said one of the sources told CNN the intention was to abduct Khashoggi, and it had not been authorized by the Saudi government. President Donald Trump telling reporters Monday that he was aware of the report but didn't know if it was correct. He said the U.S. is working with Saudi Arabia and Turkey to figure out what happened.
We are going to leave nothing uncovered. With that being said, the king firmly denied any knowledge of it. He didn't really know. Maybe I don't want to get into his mind, but it sounded to me like maybe these could have been rogue killers. Who knows? We're going to try getting to the bottom of it very soon, but his was a flat denial.
Khashoggi contributed to the Washington Post Global Opinion page. He was last seen entering the Saudi consulate on October 2nd. A joint Turkish-Saudi team of investigators searched the Saudi consulate in Istanbul late Monday as journalists filmed and shot photographs of their arrival. Turkish officials have said they fear a Saudi hit team killed and dismembered Khashoggi, who is critical of the policies of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The kingdom previously called such allegations of murder as baseless. The international incident is once again bringing to light Saudi human rights issues. Joining us now is Daniel Balson, advocacy director with Amnesty International USA. What's your organization's reaction to what has transpired in the news that the Saudis may concede that Khashoggi died after a botched interrogation?
Even taking this report at face value, the arrest, essentially the word we're talking about is the forcible disappearance of a journalist on the territory of a country's diplomatic mission, that individuals torture and that individuals killing, intentional or not, represents a grave violation of human rights. We are past the point of discussions, of platitudes about strategic patience and bilateral interests. We are at the point of consequences. What's at stake here is not only justice for Mr. Khashoggi, though that is, of course, a principal concern, but a fundamental question about norms, and that's what kind of a world are we going to live in? Is that a world where a country can lure a dissident, lure a critical journalist into its diplomatic presence and then murder them?
Even a botched interrogation, the man was coming in there to get a marriage license.
That's exactly right. And what was supposed to be the several days before some of the happiest moments of Mr. Khashoggi's life turned into his state-sponsored murder. And there's no other way to describe what happened to him. But it's important to mention that Mr. Khashoggi's scenario is part of the rule, not the exception. The Saudi government has shown absolute lack of tolerance for any forms of dissent. We saw this certainly with the arrest of numerous women human rights defenders who were protesting for simply the right to live with dignity, with freedom, is enjoyed in many other countries in the world. When we speak about human rights violations of Saudi Arabia, we cannot not speak about Yemen, the ongoing pulverization of civilians with American-made weapons. In Yemen is something that has to stop. We have been and we will continue to call for an end to all weapon sales and all military assistance to the Saudis, given their record of human rights violations both at home and internationally.
President Trump on Monday said that the Saudis denied it. They were strong in their denial, and who knows, it could have been some rogue person or group of people that did this. What is Amnesty's view on how the United States is handling the situation?
We think that this administration is completely behind on Saudi Arabia. There have been numerous opportunities to send a signal to Saudi authorities that cracking down, arresting, disappearing people simply for raising very reasonable and very fair peaceful criticisms of policy is unacceptable. So in some ways, we think Saudi authorities have got the message from the Trump administration. And that message is that rules are for others and impunity is for them.
Meaning that he will stay out of their business?
Well, meaning that if Samar Badawi, who won a State Department prize for her courage, and her arrest doesn't merit public expressions of outrage, then perhaps the door is open for all sorts of outrage.
What about the president's comments on journalists? Do you think that that could have played a role in maybe how the Saudis felt a little more emboldened to do what they wished with their displeasure?
I'm certainly not privy to any internal political calculations that are taking place in Riyadh. But what I can say is the Saudis have felt plenty emboldened on numerous fronts of late, with the complete immiseration of Yemen, the ongoing bombardment of civilians that we've documented without question as having been caused by U.S. manufactured munitions. So I think there has been no limit to the Saudis' boldness when it comes to human rights violations.
The United States used to really take a stand and put human rights as a part of what the nation stands for. Does it seem like maybe other countries like France, Germany, really taking a strong stance on this, are sort of taking over that role to call out human rights violations? Where does that leave the United States?
We at Amnesty have been very disappointed by the Trump administration stepping back from human rights internationally. This includes this administration turning its back on major multilateral human rights organizations, such as the Human Rights Council. At the same time, I think it's critical to underscore that the U.S. is and continues to be an indispensable nation. The U.S. is perhaps the number one supporter financially of the Saudi armed forces. And there's really an unfillable vacuum when the Trump administration refuses to engage constructively on human rights with respect to Saudi Arabia and more broadly.
All right. Well, that was Daniel Balson, Advocacy Director with Amnesty International USA. Thanks for being with us. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump said the oil-rich kingdom deserves severe punishment if it's responsible for the death of Khashoggi. Saudi Arabia has threatened to retaliate for any sanctions imposed against it. The warning from the world's top oil exporter came Sunday after a turbulent day on the Saudi Stock Exchange, which plunged as much as 7% on Monday before recovering. Richard Kaslerich, distinguished visiting professor at the Sharpe School of Policy at George Mason University, joins us now to talk about that part of the story. President Trump is concerned about the economic impacts of imposing sanctions on Saudi Arabia. How detrimental could it be?
He's obviously very conscious of his administration's commitment to sell arms to Saudi Arabia and other allies for the obvious economic benefit this provides the U.S. as well as the security benefit. But I think what this situation has revealed is another dimension, and that is the energy dimension, where the Saudis earlier suggested they would retaliate using the oil weapon against any state that would impose sanctions or take steps directly against Saudi Arabia. This comes at a very delicate time because of the hike in oil prices, the sanctions that are going to be applied to Iran starting early November, and these are already driving up global energy prices. And we, right now, as a country, need the Saudis to be in there pumping as much oil as they can to make sure the prices don't rise anymore. For some people, this goes back to the 1973 oil embargo when the Saudis and others simply refused to export oil and the consequences that that had both on oil prices and the economy more generally.
But doesn't the U.S. also have some leverage here because the Saudis would get money from the oil that we purchase?
Well, that would be the hope. But, you know, I think a lot depends on assessing how serious the Saudis are about protecting their interests in this. I could see them, as they did in 1973, halting oil exports for a while if they were that concerned about the steps that the U.S. and others had taken regarding this horrible murder of the journalist.
If the president fails to take any action or talk about new sanctions, does Congress have the power and the authority to override that or to do something anyway? Because they certainly seem to be threatening to do just that.
You know, there are these sanctions that are available out there called the Global Magnitsky Act. Those came out of the Russian environment, and now they are applicable globally. So Congress could certainly, you know, pass a sense of the Congress resolution or otherwise tell the administration that they believe Saudi Arabia should be subject to these same sanctions. And what the administration does then is another story. I mean, that's, you know, that's in terms of the relationship
right.
with the Congress. But Congress has already, in the case of Russia, made quite clear that it's prepared to pass, you know, additional sanctions provisions against Russia, whether the administration has asked for them or not.
There may be no good solution here either way, because,
no.
You know, you stand up for human rights and you suffer economically, or you suffer economically and you don't take a stand on human rights. It seems like it's kind of a no-win situation right now for the U.S.
Yeah, and it's one that we haven't wanted to face in terms of the Saudis, because of the importance both on the energy side but also politically, as far as the policies the administration has been trying to pursue with Israel and Palestine. Whatever
mm-hmm.
you think about them, they have wanted the Saudis to be on board with what they were trying to do. Now I think all of these aspects of cooperation are up in the air, pending, you know, what the Saudis ultimately say happened with the journalist or what the administration does with President Trump's fairly general but fairly strong statement that if it turns out that there was some responsibility here, that the U.S. would take strong action. So we're in an unpleasant situation between two countries who need each other a lot right now.
All right, that's Richard Kozlerich, distinguished visiting professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Gambia launches Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Why the midterm election is on diaspora media's agenda. Pakistan's fencing of Afghan border remains a source of mutual tensions. And the U.S. budget deficit hits a six-year high. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. North and South Korea have agreed that they both want to begin a joint project to modernize and connect their rail and roadways before the end of the year. At a high-level meeting on Monday, the two nations agreed to a proposal that will see teams beginning to inspect transportation links. They also agreed to hold talks in November related to families separated by the Korean War. Some of the plans appear to violate sanctions imposed by the UN Security Council. It also seems to counter concerns by the Trump administration over what some see as premature enthusiasm by South Korean President Moon Jae-in to move closer to North Korea when it still has nuclear weapons. Ken Gause, director of the Advisory Analytics Research Program at the CNA think tank in Washington, D.C., tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman that it's time for the U.S. to adopt a new strategy.
We are fundamentally misunderstanding where North Korea stands. North Korea has not agreed to unilateral denuclearization, which, if you read the Western media, that seems to be what we believe that North Korea has signed up for. North Korea has signed up for denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. This is a term that North Korea has used dating back to 1954 when they started talking about nuclear peace-free zones in Asia. It does not mean that they have signed up to get rid of their nuclear weapons on the front end of a negotiated process. And I think that this is something that that is causing debate between the United States and South Korea on how best to engage North Korea and get them to move down the path toward eventual denuclearization. The United States believes that this should be done through a pressure campaign that forces North Korea to make substantive progress on unilateral denuclearization up front before we give them incentives and security guarantees as we go through this process. Whereas South Korea believes, and I think North Korea probably also believes, and I know that China seems to agree to, the idea that this should be part of a peace regime and that denuclearization should be embedded as a confidence-building measures, as are these rail and road networks, and also economic and security guarantees that become a series of confidence-building measures that you work through a phased process that at the back end of the process, eventually you will hope to achieve denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, including denuclearization of North Korea.
With the apparent leaning of the White House, President Trump and his advisors seem to be still demanding that denuclearization take place before any of these sanctions are lifted. And how do you react to that? What should be happening here as far as you're concerned?
Well, I can understand that this would be what the Trump administration wants to say publicly, because this plays well inside the United States, and we're heading into a midterm elections, and the administration needs to look tough on countries such as North Korea. But if you look at it from the North Korean position, that giving in to unilateral denuclearization without having it embedded into some sort of a peace process, in other words, it's denuclearization first, that's basically a zero-sum game where one side wins and the other side loses, which means that North Korea would lose face. So from their point of view, doing unilateral denuclearization with verification that went along with that would be something that they would see as being undermining the legitimacy of the regime. And so I think the United States really needs to, is really stuck in a very difficult situation, because internally, domestically, politically, it makes sense to tout denuclearization as being the be-all, end-all of our North Korea policy. But in order to have traction with North Korea and actually reach some sort of satisfactory result toward eventual denuclearization, we're going to have to move off of denuclearization as being our be-all, end-all goal. And that's very hard for the United States to sell domestically.
You think it is a safe bet to trust North Korea?
Well, I think basically you need to understand what are the things that drive Kim Jong-un. And it's very simple. He has to satisfy two requirements. One is regime survival, and the other is the perpetuation of Kim family rule. Everything else is secondary. So we have to take that into account to understand those are his equities. And if we can come up with a strategy that takes advantage of those equities and also kind of overlaps with our own equities of peace and security and stability in the region, maybe we can find a way forward. And I think we can trust the North Korean regime not to violate those two equities.
That's Ken Gause at the CNA think tank in Washington. In the U.S. state of Georgia, voting rights advocacy groups are suing the state's top election official, Secretary of State Brian Kemp, who also is a Republican nominee for governor in one of this year's highest-profile state races, in which Democrat Stacey Abrams is seeking to become the state's first black governor. It was the latest legal development this week involving voting rights that could influence the November 6th election in several other states. Joining us now to discuss is Abe Rakov, chairman of the board with the group Let America Vote. So let's start with Georgia. What exactly is this lawsuit alleging?
Georgia's Secretary of State Brian Kemp is holding hostage about 53,000 voter registrations, and more than 80% of them belong to people of color. So what he's doing is refusing to fully process them before the election And it just happens to be an election where he's seeking a promotion to become governor. 53,000 voter registrations. This is a race that could be decided by that many votes. It's very close. So he's trying to put as many hurdles as possible in front of voters who he thinks probably won't vote for him. These voters can still vote provisionally, but all that does is add more confusion on election day, and it helps Kemp with his goal to stop as many fellow Georgians as possible from making their voices heard.
When you say he's holding these registrations, what do you mean by that? What is he doing?
He won't process them. They have a bunch of different reasons the Secretary of State can hold them back. He's trying to make voters put more information forward than they normally have to in order to get them processed. And it just happens to be 80% of them are people of color. So this is a very targeted thing. It's not only racist. It's clearly racist. It's also anti-democracy. He's clearly trying to rake his own election.
How do you know it's suppression and not just a policy that he's trying to make sure voters have their proper information?
Secretary Kemp doesn't deserve the benefit of the doubt on this. There's a lot of secretaries of state who are competent people who do it very fairly, and Brian Kemp isn't one of them. He has tried over and over again to stop people from voting. He's just not up for this job.
When you say stop people from voting, are you referring to a particular part of the population?
Most of the time it is targeted at people of color. There have been polling places that have shut down in Georgia in majority minority areas. This targeting is 80% of people are people of color. That's not a coincidence. So this is a very targeted thing.
Are you saying it's because he's a Republican and the minorities generally vote for Democrats?
That's what it looks like he's doing. I think there are him and Republicans across the country are scared for their jobs. And instead of trying to come up with policy proposals to win over voters, they're just trying to rig the election. It's very strange that these Republicans, including secretaries of state, have become anti-voter. But it's a political strategy. They're trying to shape the electorate to make it as favorable to them as possible. And they're just painting a broad brush and disenfranchising people of color more than anyone else. And they've done it for years.
Is voter suppression limited to one of our political parties, or is it widespread depending on the election cycle?
Unfortunately, it's limited to one party. It's the Republican Party right now thinks it needs to limit the electorate. Democrats across the country want every single eligible voter to vote in every single election, and may the best candidate win. And Republicans are very worried that if that happens, they're going to lose some more elections. So they just have tried to tamp down voting, which is one of the more un-American things I think of.
It's not illegal, apparently, to do what the Secretary of State is doing. But are there any legal issues that come with the person running for office to also be in charge of the vote in his race?
If they're competent, there shouldn't be. In this case, Brian Kemp isn't competent, and he should resign because he is doing a poor job as Secretary of State. And if he doesn't resign, he can recuse himself. But there are a lot of secretaries of state across the country that have managed to run for office while also running a fair election. He's just not one of them.
Why do you think it is that in a society that professes to be so strongly in favor of free and fair elections, democracy, why do we see this happen?
I think when politicians get power, they tend to do whatever they can to keep power. And in this case, it's Republicans trying to change how our elections work, change who is able to vote to make it more favorable. It's really one of the reasons why we started Let America Vote in 2017, because we wanted to create a political consequence for politicians that tried to stop eligible voters from voting. There just had never been that before. That was the full-time job of an organization. We've been winning in the courts and winning some at the state level, but we wanted to make it so when politicians do something like this, there is a political consequence and they don't get to keep their job. And
besides Georgia, are you seeing any other states that are cause for alarm as far as voter suppression?
In Indiana, the Secretary of State there purged 460,000 people from the rolls after the 2016 election, and there's a very competitive Senate race there. In Ohio, the Secretary of State purged people from the rolls just because they didn't vote in an election, and that has some of the more competitive races in the country. One of the worst ones that we've seen recently is in North Dakota, Republicans passed a law that made it harder for Native Americans to vote. What they did is they said that you have to have a residential address in order to vote, knowing full well that Native Americans who live on reservations, many of them use P.O. boxes and not a residential address. So this is purely targeting one group of people in North Dakota, which has a very competitive Senate race, and trying to stop Native Americans from voting. Again, one of the more un-American things you can possibly do. And you're just seeing this pop up all over the country. Eligible voters should be able to vote.
That's Abe Rakov, chairman of the board of the group Let America Vote. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. Democrats are energized to vote in the upcoming midterm elections, hoping to defeat or diminish the Republican congressional majority. We talk with Democratic strategist Will Marshall, president of the Progressive Policy Institute, about the obstacles and incentives for Democrats in November. That's Press Conference USA, Saturday and Sunday, on The Voice of America.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, it is one of the easiest ways to stop the spread of disease. The U.S. Center for Disease Control says spending just 20 seconds washing hands with soap and water can reduce illness in more than a million children who die each year from preventable disease. Two young women from New Delhi who studied design in New York say they have a solution, turning a chore into playtime. They're launching a new hygiene product called Soapen on Global Handwashing Day. Arash Arabasadi reports.
Once playtime is over, it is one of the easiest things we can do to keep ourselves and others healthy. But most of us are doing it wrong.
It's such a simple habit to do, and the fact that people aren't doing it, and it's resulting in actually in death, so it's just shocking. So we decided on coming up with a fun solution.
Two entrepreneurs from India created a new hygiene product.
Soapen is a soap that kids can draw with. It's a fun way to teach kids how to wash their hands.
Young people make a mess with Soapen and then have to scrub to get it off.
Kids actually wash their hands for the proper amount of time because they're drawing on their hands, and underwater they have to rub really hard to remove the drawing. So actually washing their hands instead of just going underwater and, you know, 1 second wash and off.
In an effort to get their product on the market, the two women applied for a spot at a business incubator in Georgetown called Halcyon, located on the aptly named Prospect Street.
Being an entrepreneur is really, really hard. There's a kind of an up and down roller coaster ride. One day things are going great, the next day things are terrible. And if you're doing that alone, it can be really, really challenging.
Halcyon places social entrepreneurs with business professionals who help them refine a marketing strategy.
Without an incubator like Halcyon, I don't think we would be able to make or envision social impact as greatly as we are able to right now.
Soapen is being launched with support from Halcyon. UNICEF reports that 1.5 million kids die each year as a result of diarrhea, and that proper hand washing could reduce that number by 40%. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen has died at the age of 65. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
He was one of the wealthiest men in the world with an estimated worth of more than $20 billion, according to Forbes. Paul Allen helped co-found Microsoft with childhood friend Bill Gates in 1975. The company took off 5 years later when IBM Corporation decided to move into personal computers and Microsoft was picked to provide the operating system. Allen eventually branched out into ventures in professional sports, aerospace, and philanthropy. He's credited with giving more than $2 billion to causes dealing with ocean health, homelessness, and scientific research. Paul Allen died at the age of 65. I'm Mike Rossia.
Well, Kensington Palace has announced that Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, are expecting a child. The announcement came as Harry and his wife arrived in Sydney, Australia for a 16-day trip that includes several other nations. The trip will include attending the Invictus Games, a visit to a Sydney Zoo, and a visit to a rural flying doctor service. People in the U.S. are reacting to the pregnancy announcement with excitement. Here's Nikki Johnson of Virginia.
I mean, honestly, she's an American princess. She's also just a really cool woman. And I think the world will be blessed to have one of her kids in the world.
The prince and the American former actress got married in a glittering service in Windsor in May. You're listening to International Edition. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to director Tracy Carter and engineer John Ellison. I'm Lori London. Have a great day.